From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Magia Street,
Berkeley,
Hercules, California,
Bubble Park City College,
South San Francisco,
Downtown,
OTL,
Pittsburgh, P-World,
Oakland, Corona Heights, San Francisco.
Coming up, Alameda County building codes have got owners feeling like they can't win.
It's really easy. It's just like one stroke of my pen and they tear your house down and you'll pay for that.
Also, we wax philosophic on the fate of Christmas trees.
You never stop to think about what happens to a Christmas tree when the Christmas tree is done. It just goes away.
While Christmas trees might be on their way out, some things from the holiday season tend to stay with us.
I don't know. Those memories are the most precious to me because they're going to die with me.
You can start making new memories with us right now in 2012. Cross Currents is next. Happy New Year and welcome to 2012. Well, over the recent holidays, you might have seen some yard decorations that were a bit over the top, like this one from the TV show Roseanne.
This holiday season, we're asking everyone to restrict their decorations to simple white lights in order to avoid eyesores, such as last year's faded plastic Santas and three-legged reindeer.
Well, what are we supposed to do with them? Shoot them?
They've singled us out, honey. We're the tackiest house in the whole neighborhood.
Well, this year I say we go for the national title.
Like Roseanne's Neighborhood Association, cities set standards for what our homes and yards can look like. Some of the rules are based on health and safety. So if your building's falling over, you're supposed to repair it. Other rules are there to protect property values. For example, you aren't allowed to let garbage pile up in your yard. But in Oakland, some people think the process has broken down. The Alameda County Civil Grand Jury report released last July says the building inspectors are purposefully making it difficult for property owners to get up to code. City staff admit they've got problems, but they say it's a bit more complicated than the grand jury report would have you believe. KLW's Callie Schanefeld looked into the story.
One day last September, 42-year-old Omar El-Baroudi appeared on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. In the photo, he's standing at the back of his West Oakland home. At the time the photo was taken, the house had been boarded up for more than 2 years. An Oakland building inspector had said his home was blighted. El-Baroudi disagreed. He said he'd been trying to improve things.
I bought it for $185,000. There was definitely, it was part of the neighborhood, there were squatters.
By the time he made the headlines, El-Baroudi's home had been caught in Oakland city bureaucracy for more than 3 years. Dozens of other Oakland homeowners had had a similar experience, and they all said the same thing, that the city was making it impossible for them to fix up their homes. An Alameda County grand jury agreed. To understand what happened, we need to go back a few years to when El-Baroudi first bought his house, a small two-bedroom on Magnolia Street.
I got in April of 2008, pretty much April Fool's Day.
It was his first time owning a home, and he had big plans.
I mean, I was going to have an ice machine and a washer-dryer. It was going to be a lot different.
A lot different, that is, than what the house looks like now. The basement and back windows are boarded up, the yard is overgrown, and the inside is completely gutted. But the neighborhood's not all bad. One side of Magnolia Street is full of old original houses, like El-Baroudi's. Across the street are brand new half-million-dollar lofts. And down the block are warehouses from Oakland's industrial past.
Now it's really kind of up and coming, and there's a lot of artists and a lot of young people coming here. And there's just a complete mix of neighbors, from people who drive into the city and go to their financial job every day to people who have a part-time job weeding for the city of Oakland out on medians, living over here, and it's a lower-class neighborhood with, like a upper-class jacket on.
When he first saw it, El-Baroudi's home was one of three vacant buildings, all in a row on the block. He says the windows would glow at night from the fires squatters were burning inside.
And it was just some of those shopping cart people. And so they'd be stripping wires here, bringing their recycling here.
After buying the property, El-Baroudi got the squatters to leave, moved in, and started cleaning up. Not just his house, but the others around him. He used to remodel houses himself, so he knew what he was doing. And he says his neighbors were glad to see the improvements.
These were all empty, and I cleaned all the fronts of all of them. And I met everybody, and they're like, this is so great.
Still, 3 months after moving in, he got a notice from a City of Oakland inspector.
Then the odyssey began with its one lien after another and one threat after another, and either, you know, it's really easy. It's just like one stroke of my pen and they tear your house down and you'll pay for that.
A lien is basically something the city files against a property that says the owner owes them money. And if the building is sold, the city gets its money first. With each lien comes a nearly $1,000 fine, and it makes it difficult to get loans on the property. Here's how a lien happens. Someone calls Oakland's Community and Economic Development Agency, or CEDA, and complains. They send out an inspector, who usually finds something that doesn't meet city code, and then they find the owner.
Blight is unquestionably a huge problem down here, but like they pushed the landlord out before me. They created this blight.
We are in Audit Oakland CEDA's Operations Central.
Michelle Cassens is the founder of Audit Oakland CEDA, an advocacy group that monitors the city's blight control efforts. She says she realized liens were a problem for a lot of Oakland residents back in August of 2009. She takes me through her office to show me what she found.
Everything you see around you, all of these papers, are public records that I spent the last 2 years requesting and receiving, or more likely, going and getting myself and printing out.
She says she hit the public records jackpot when she realized Oakland was issuing hundreds of liens. Many of them were equivalent to the value of the homes.
I noticed that for Oakland, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these filed, but for every other city in Alameda County, there were none.
And Oakland's policy has driven many homeowners back to renting.
And now I'm renting a house down the street, everything else is fixed, and this one looks exactly the same, and quite frankly, I don't pick up garbage in this town anymore.
For Omar El-Baroudi, the fines piled up quickly. His building inspector claimed his windows were the wrong size and that his railing and vinyl siding weren't permitted. El-Baroudi says none of these complaints had merit, but his inspector insisted he come in to file a 6-month compliance plan to fix the problems. That cost him hundreds of dollars. Then he applied for building permits, but it took 6 months for them to come through, and by then his compliance plan had expired.
And my inspector absolutely had no empathy at all. I mean, she would be writing these crazy fines on me, threatening to tear down my house. And when I told her that I was going bankrupt, which was a distinct possibility and still is, she just was like, oh, good. Well, when you leave the house, be sure to call me and tell me, because that'll be different paperwork for me.
Last summer, an Alameda County grand jury report supported the concerns of El-Baroudi and others. More than 20 people showed up to testify at the first city council hearing on the issue. Councilwoman Jane Bruner made a motion to solve some of the problems outlined in the report. One was to stop using liens until a new policy could be created.
We do still need liens. If you don't have liens, you have no hammer. But you really want to make sure that they've been noticed, they have a time to object, there's been an appeal, and then you do the lien, that you don't do it right away.
CEDA's Margareta Lynn says in the future they'll file a lot fewer liens, and they won't file them against low-income residential homeowners like El-Baroudi.
We do need, however, to find ways to provide constructive notice to interested parties that that property may have some issues with it. And that's our legal duty or moral duty to the community at large.
They also have a duty to respond to the more than 8,000 complaints every year. Part of the problem in the past was that an inspector was sent to every home in question, which usually resulted in some kind of fee to the homeowner. Lynn says they're trying to change that.
We're trying to avoid having any interactions with you, period, because the city is costly.
Now the city sends courtesy notices instead of inspectors to a home with a complaint against it. If the owner solves the problem and sends proof to the city, no fines or inspectors will ever be involved.
An important starting place is changing the culture of the organization.
Also, Lynn says they're creating a way to appeal so accused homeowners can take their case to a neutral party.
I think a lot of good faith efforts are occurring by the city and by building services staff to address the issues that were raised by the grand jury report and issues that the city was aware of prior to the release of the report itself.
This is the second time in a decade that a grand jury has found the same problems with how CEDA operates. Omar El-Baroudi, for one, has little faith that things can change.
To be honest, I'm just freaking tired right now. You know, it's been a long 3 years. And it's kind of been hard on everybody, particularly hard on building. And this was rough. I mean, I got the loan. They said I can get my old permits back because they had expired also. So, you know, on the one hand, it should be, like, really exciting. But for whatever reason, I'm just really tired right now. But I'm going to get excited. You know, because, I mean, I do want to live here. I mean, it's, you know, I put these roses in 3 years ago. They miss me.
In Oakland, I'm Callie Schanefeld for Cross Currents.
And an update on that story. Building Services will convene a 12-person task force of property owners, staff, tenants, real estate professionals, and public servants in February. They plan to also report their progress to the City Council in March. You can find a link to that story and all of our stories at klw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Well, the building codes in some Bay Area cities can be extremely difficult to work with. Getting rid of your Christmas tree is remarkably simple. At least that's what it looks like around KLW. Just blocks from our radio station in San Francisco, Christmas trees are sitting on the side of the road, ready to be carted away by someone, anyone, who will notice. KLW's Erica Moo followed the fate of some of those trees, and her journey led her to some very interesting places.
If you're like me, the sight of inflatable Santas and fake twinkling icicles anytime after December 25th may cause you to roll down the car window and yell out, "Christmas is over." I'm no Grinch. I just think holiday sentimentality has its place, and its expiration date is approximately 11:59 p.m. on December 25th. And while my neighbors can continue to flaunt their cheerful, plastic, and permanently anchored reindeer, there is one thing they really have to get rid of: their Christmas tree. Throughout January, people eventually dump their evergreens on the side of the road, so I have to look at them all month long. Well, I decided to do something different this year and follow these ghosts of Christmas past as they travel from the lot to the lake and landfill.
And you're going to be taking the rope, and you've got to get the tree secured to the chains.
That's Pete Alexander, manager of the East Bay Regional Park Fisheries Program. He's teaching a group of 75 volunteers how to tie a Christmas tree to a heavy chain. It's a strange sight, and some of the younger volunteers aren't sure how to explain it.
What are you guys doing here today?
Throwing trees into the lake.
Gonna plant them on the side of the ocean.
Making habitat for fish.
How are you gonna make habitat for fish?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Oh, wait, putting the leftover Christmas trees and putting them on chains.
That's Kali Milimaki of Castro Valley, Jatel Desai of San Jose, and Emily Williams of Fremont. They're here at the muddy edge of Quarry Lake in Fremont just as dawn is breaking. And you know what? All of them are kind of right. Again, program manager Pete Alexander.
If you go underwater when the trees are underwater, you'll see algae growing on them. The limbs that are, you know, of a Christmas tree are fairly small, but they grow sometimes an inch of algae on the outside of them. And so it really moves a lot of nutrients up through the system, up into the fish. Then the insects are there feeding on the algae, and the fish come in to feed on the insects. So instead of having a flat, two-dimensional bottom, you have a three-dimensional bottom.
Right now, Alexander's got 800 to 1,000 unsold Christmas trees and 250 acres of lake to put them in. And he set up a process to make it happen. Milimaki, Desai, and Williams are fluffing up the Christmas trees, laying them down, and tying them to chains spreading like rays from the edge of the lake.
You never stop to think about what happens to a Christmas tree when the Christmas tree is done. It just goes away.
That's Stacy Thomas DeLang, who came here with her teenage son, Carter.
Now, every time the kids come out here to Quarry Lake, they'll think, I put Christmas trees in there. I helped to rehabilitate it.
Over the next 8 years, the trees will eventually become submerged as rainfall causes the water levels to rise. Instead of a forest nesting birds and squirrels, the trees will look more like an underwater reef harboring large and smallmouth bass. But that's just 1,000 Christmas trees. After the holidays, the Bay Area's got maybe 1 million to get rid of. That's where this comes in. You're hearing the Diamond 1463B, the two-week-old, 1,200-horsepower, industry-grade grinder is at the Newby Island Compost Facility in Milpitas. If you live on the peninsula and put your Christmas tree in the compost bin, well, now you know what happened to it.
We have a little sample set up there. I think they've got like 20 Christmas trees. That won't even make it a hiccup.
That's General Manager Mark Buncher. He and I are standing next to the huge grinder and a massive pile of organic waste. It doesn't smell bad. In fact, it smells a little piney. Once these Christmas trees meet the Diamond 1463B, the chopped up remains are added to 7-foot high rows of decomposing yard waste for the next 51 days. The result? Perfect fodder for garden beds, golf courses, and erosion control.
Have yourself a merry
Standing here in front of the grinder, a song pops into my head. Maybe it's not so bad to extend the holidays. Christmas trees do have a life after Christmas, and it's not standing limply in my neighbor's living room window. They're making the Bay Area a better place. Now, if only I could get that plastic reindeer to the Diamond 1463B.
A merry little Christmas.
For Cross Currents, I'm Erica Moo.
Make the Yuletide gay.
Want to help create an underwater Christmas tree reef? Pete Alexander and the East Bay Regional Park District will be at Quarry Lake in Fremont this Saturday morning at 8 a.m. For more information about that, go to our website. It's klw.org.
Here we are as in olden days, happy golden days of yore.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The holiday season in the U.S. usually involves lots of eating and drinking. Turkey, mashed potatoes, ham, fondue, eggnog, spiced wine, tamales, cookies, pumpkin pie. It's also a time of the year when many people break out traditional family recipes. Cross Currents engineer Chris Hoff, for example, bakes hundreds of Pfeffernitzes with his family. It's an old German cookie recipe. And even though we all remember quirky family dishes, we don't always appreciate that home cooking until we've actually left home. Joyce Lynn Conrad sat down with her friend and co-worker Jeff Paula to talk about how her heritage influenced her interest in food, which eventually led both of them to teach at the Edible Schoolyard. Lynn Conrad shared her favorite memory of her grandmother's cooking at the StoryCorps booth in the Contemporary Jewish Museum of San Francisco.
I'm trying to think of the ones that aren't really funny. She made this amazing dish for me. The funny thing is, so many of the foods that my grandmother cooked, I have no idea what they're called. I don't even know what they're called in Chinese.
Right.
And I don't know if they're in cookbooks or anything, but she makes this dish out of sweet rice flour, and you make a dough out of it, and she would roll it out into like a big circle and then toast it on a skillet. So it's like almost like a mochi consistency. Mm-hmm. And then she would spread like American creamy peanut butter on it, like Skippy peanut butter.
Nice.
And then sprinkle granulated sugar on top and roll it up and then cut it. So they're like these little roulades.
Uh-huh.
And I would come home from school on the school bus and walk up the hill where we lived in Lafayette. And she would have this plate of this sticky, sweet peanut butter rice roll waiting for me. And the story about this food is that I, you know, went to college, and of course the food was horrible there, and everyone would always say, oh, I can't wait for my mother's this or that when I go home. And my mother doesn't know how to cook at all. And I would go home, and my grandmother was really aging. She's turning 97 in a few weeks.
Wow.
And she still made that. She had stopped cooking because she would burn the house down. And she still made this simple dessert of this glutinous rice flour dough with this American brand peanut butter rolled up and sliced with little toothpicks in it. And I just, that's not something that I make. That memory is mine and kind of mine alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something I think I'll make for my children. And, but I mean that in because I don't know how, really.
Right.
And, I think, I don't know, those memories are the most precious to me because they're going to die with me.
Right. It sounds pretty great to have
delicious.
Grandma waiting with yummy little treats when you come
home. I mean,
home.
Right. I was a pretty lucky little
hill.
Kid,
that's,
you know? She,
so
and she, that's how she told me she loved me.
Yeah,
with
that's,
food.
That's sweet. That's sweet.
You just heard Joyce Lynn Conrad talking with her friend Jeff Paula. They spoke at the StoryCorps booth at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. If you want to participate in StoryCorps and tell your own story, go to our website to find out how. It's klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. This past year has seen a lot of momentous global news stories, from the Arab Spring uprisings to the recent death of Kim Jong-il. Back stateside, one of the biggest stories is the ever-changing contest to become the Republican presidential nominee.
Corporations are people, my friend.
Okay, Libya.
It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
Just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
It's like, you know, handing up this and saying, this glass of water is a glass of beer. Well, you can call it a glass of beer, but it's not a glass of beer. It's a glass of water. And water is what water is. Marriage is what marriage is.
Got all this stuff twirling around in my head.
Any ad which quotes what I said on Sunday is a falsehood.
The education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
San Francisco comedian Will Durst has compiled his own top 10 comedic news stories of 2011.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with my 8th annual top 10 comedic news stories of the year. Now, please be warned, this list is not to be confused with the top 10 legitimate news stories of the year. No, no, no. They're as different as three bean chili and paisley bow ties. Like strip mining slag heaps and little rubber duckies, wired-haired dwarf goats, and plastic dinnerware. Now, these are the events from the year of our Lord, 2011, that most lent themselves to mocking and scoffing and taunting in ample amounts. Number 10. Wisconsin Senate plays hide-and-seek with Governor Scott Walker. They ran across the border to Illinois and hid out for a month. Yeah, like Illinois doesn't have enough problems with politicians doing nothing. Number 9, the budget battles. You had to admire the year-long Republican negotiating stance. No, 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 no. What are you guys, for? Number 8, the Super Committee. Slower than a slug on Thorazine, less powerful than a soggy Kleenex, unable to compromise in a million years. Number 7, Donald Trump. I want to see Barack Obama's birth certificate. Yeah? Well, we want to see your DNA. First, you get to prove to us that you're a carbon-based life form. Number 6, Rick Perry. The candidate for those of you who could never cozy up to George Bush due to all of his intellectual elitism. Number 5, Occupy Wall Street. Giving the whole country a chance to experience Burning Man, only without any of that playa dust or art. Number 4, Herman Cain. His campaign fell victim to a classic case of he said, she said, she said, she said, she said, she said, she said. Number 3, Barack Obama. Continually compromising with the Republicans the same way the Titanic compromised with that iceberg. Number 2, the death of Osama bin Laden. He collected porn, used herbal Viagra, and if you believe the videos, he hogged the remote. Hate Americans? Looks like he was practicing to be one. And the number 1 comedic news story of the year 2011, Anthony Weiner. And it was his own damn fault. He had the choice of pronunciation. Could have gone with Weiner, still a lousy name for a politician, or he could have gone whole hog. Yes, we spell it W-E-I-N-E-R, but it's pronounced Schultz. For Cross Currents, I'm Will Durst.
That's Will Durst, a Bay Area political comic and satirist. You can go to our website to find links to his upcoming shows and other comedic dispatches. And if you've got a favorite news story from 2011, you can let us hear about it. Leave us a message on our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. Or you can get in touch through our website. It's klw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hana Baba, Erica Mu, Audrey Dilling, Jen Chien, Julie Kane, Nina Morente, Holly McDeed, Julia Lundberg, Casey Miner, Rena Palta, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Seth Samuel. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. The music you're listening to is by The Hooks. They live in San Francisco now, after moving from Sligo, Ireland. You can hear their more melodic form of punk, along with their non-traditional versions of Irish traditional music, on Saturday at the Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco. To hear that band and all of the local bands featured on our show, go to our website. It's klw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.